You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 257 is Josh Joplin. He has deep folk roots, but for the most part, his music falls into the category of rock singer-songwriter, including what you're hearing now, Camera One, his big hit from the 2001 album Useful Music, which just got a silver anniversary rework slash reissue. So in fact, the version you're hearing right now is the newly recorded version. Before this, he had three albums in the 90s, and after this, he's released seven more albums, so about 11 in total, plus some EPs and things. We're discussing Goodbye Berlin from his last full album, Gap Year, 2025, History of I Do from Figure Drawing, 2023, Juniper from Boxing Nostalgic from 1997, and we'll conclude by listening to High, Low, and Wide from the self-titled album by Among the Oak and Ash from 2008. Learn more at joshjoplingroup.com. Learn more about this podcast at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or support the effort, making your experience ad-free and getting my episode notes at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of Camera One, of course, your big hit, but this is the 25th anniversary complete re-recording, right? It's the silver anniversary master, but it's not just a remastering. It's
a silver anniversary master. Yeah, complete re-record.
And is that just because you don't own the originals and you want to be able to license it for commercials and get all the money? Is that, that's the normal reason people re-record?
That is a part of all of this journey. I have been lucky enough to get most of my recordings back, which most musicians can't do. But it's more about celebrating this summer the 25th anniversary. So we just all figured, let's do this. And that's the majority of the reason we're doing it. But the benefit is, yeah, I own this version.
So we want to get pretty quickly to, well, the latest full album besides this complete Useful Music Silver Anniversary Sessions, which is sort of what we're promoting here. But the last album, complete new materials, 2025's, is it just pronounced Gap Year? G-P-Y-R?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, Gap Year.
Goodbye Berlin, the single I had picked from that. Do we want to see just a little bit about the journey from your hit in, what, this was 2001? Am I doing the math
yep.
right? Yes. that I saw you recorded three albums in the 90s, which are not really even on the streaming services. I had to, you know, you have a group, a compilation from two of them, not from the first.
It's basically just a compilation of the two records we did. Very early days. We started basically as a group that I was going to pay everybody to just play music with me. And then it just evolved into the group. And in that time span, we were sort of recording music and putting out records. And things had sort of evolved into where we really were a band and regretfully called Josh Joplin Group or Josh Joplin Band at that time. You know, because that insinuates that it wasn't a band. It was just me paying people who were to play with me.
I mean, as a long-term strategy of name recognition, it seems like that was not a bad idea.
Right. Well, it's funny, you know, a lot of these 25 years have been just looking back, and I'm not a huge person who sticks to nostalgia and to looking back very often. So really the truth is that Useful Music has been the first time I have really looked back at it. We were going to release it as a 20th anniversary, and I wasn't doing any of these things for it. It was going to be a celebration 5 years ago. But because I had those 5 years, I was thinking about all of the things that would be sort of fun to do with the group, and also looking back on that time, which for me is incredible because I had one foot in the old music industry and one foot in what was going to be the industry that we probably know now, which is, you know, consolidated radio, home recording, and Napster at that time, and, you know, which would lead to streaming. And so much has changed. And in those 25 years, social media has come to mean something very different to what we mirror for one another on our cameras. So, yeah, gave me some time to think. As far as name recognition and things like that, clearly I have not done the job that my band's name was benefiting me to do.
I will say I very clearly recognized the song, but I didn't know who it was by when I.
Yeah, just to simplify life, when people ask me what do I do, and I say I'm a musician, most people say, "What else do you do?" Because most people haven't made a living, I guess, in music, and I've been very, very fortunate to have. So I just say I'm a one-hit wonder, which I know is very controversial for musicians who are people who had a really big song. And I don't know a ton of people in this community that I'm a part of, but I say one-hit wonder just because it allows me to move on from having to explain my life in some way. And it seems like I hate that question, what do you do? I never ask people what they do. I think it's kind of rude, but people ask that, especially, you know, Americans love to know what you do, because I think it's so much a part of our identity. Our work is our identity. So people think, oh, what do you do? Is just a part of getting to know somebody. But I definitely respect people who had a really big song and don't want to be called a one-hit wonder. And I also am fine being called a one-hit wonder.
Answering that question, you get very granular and mundane. Goodbye, Berlin. You apparently get on planes a lot, go play shows different places, get on another plane, stay in a hotel, get on another plane. Can you say a little bit about where you're at by Gap Year 2025 and this song before we hear it?
All of these songs were initially, to be honest, and this is crazy granular, were all for a show that I had written. And so it's a lot about my life at a time when I was much younger and coming up in the rave scene in Baltimore, which I wasn't a participant in per se, but I was very close to because I had friends who were very much involved in that. So Goodbye Berlin became a song for me that I wanted to use in this show that never came to pass because of the evil that was COVID. But I had been in Berlin and I had taken all of my friends' aspirations to their dance scene and their club scene, did everything I could to bring back stories for them about what I saw. And it just became so much a bigger trip for me because I didn't want to leave Berlin. And it was such a beautiful experience for me being there, the people there. And I got on a plane feeling like I need to turn around and get off this plane and stay. But I was too scared to do that. You know, obviously my life would have been completely different at the age of 18 or whatever I was to have done that. But that to me was the ultimate version of myself as a fly on the wall for all of these people who were much more braver than I ever was. And so I came home and I got to tell my friends the story, but I didn't stay there. All of my friends would have stayed and gotten arrested and deported and all of those things and been happy for it. And that wasn't me.
All right. So a much more specific story. This is not actually a touring song. This is about way before then. Well, let's hear it.
Out of time, out of bed, out of order in my head. Suppose we drove as far as we could, never found our way if we could. Turn back around without regrets. Every day that waits forgets about me. Arrive by taxi, check my bag. Watch the clock and feel the lag between now and the time we had. Arrivals, departures, it doesn't matter whose heart hurts. Goodbye, Berlin, I miss you every chance. just return back home again. Put on clothes and pack your bags. I'm with you if they should ask. Arrivals, departures, it doesn't matter whose heart hurts.
Stylistically, how are you putting together the band, the ensemble, what the sounds are going to be? You've got some interesting sort of melodica keyboard sounds in there. Say a little about what the band is at this point.
Well, the band is always the group, and the group is usually people I've played with for a long, long time. So for Gap Year, it's my friend Lorenzo Wolf, who has gone on to produce lots of big records or pieces of big records. And he and I sort of started out where he was playing bass for me when he was very young. And we made the record with the intention of creating something quickly, because I don't love to sit around and think about recording and be in it for months. And I respect everybody's different choices that way too. But we wanted to make the record in 2 days, maybe. That's typically how, 2-3 days. That's how I like to work. So we just got down to it. One of my very first drummers, Ani Cordero, she's singing on it. Emily Holden, who's a very close friend to both Lorenzo and I, she sings on it. And Kevin Joaquin Garcia, who plays in another band altogether, different kind of music called the Steel Wheels, joined, and that was a lot of fun too. So it was just a very immediate what fits here, and all I knew is I wanted to play guitar and Moog pedals, these pedals I got from a friend of mine years ago.
Okay, so you're doing the more 80s, the fake delay, whack, 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 rather than the chuck, 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 chuck guitar, the other one.
Yes.
It sounds very choreographed in terms of just, you know, it's not like you play the intro and then the whole band comes in. It's that they keep coming in and going out, coming in and going out. If you did this in 2 days, does that mean that you actually just did that in the mixing, or did you have to choreograph that?
We talked it over a lot. And how we recorded it was, I sang live with my electric. Lorenzo sat in front of me playing bass in the control room while Kevin played drums in another room. We essentially did it that way, but we talked about the arrangements. And Kevin actually came up with a beautiful arrangement on the last tune called Predator and Prey, which we hadn't thought of until we got into the studio. But yeah, it was, for the most part, we talked it over for maybe as long as 15 minutes or 20 minutes, maybe ran through some things, but then we just sort of played it. And then Ani and Emily and our friend Sarah came in. Sarah plays keyboard much better than I do. And so she was playing the piano and the keyboard. And Ani and Emily came in to sing the backup part.
Yeah, let me jump to the sort of instrumental. There's sort of a 80s keyboard and a 80s single note delay guitar on the left. Yeah, so any thought about that choice of we're going to do a sort of riff-oriented instrumental break instead of having a solo or something?
One, I can't play solo guitar, so that makes a lot of choices for us. I think the biggest solo that we have on the record was actually played by my daughter, who can tear up a guitar. We kind of left that moment to her. But yeah, for the most part, I don't really play solos. So anything that I do that tends to be solo-esque just usually is like me riffing on a chord that I'm playing with either my ring finger and my pinky finger, or just trying to create the essence. But I really wanted the rhythm of bum, 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 to be that rave and old Soft Cell and just Joy Division and all those bands from the 80s or 70s and 80s that had those tremendous rhythmic guitar moments, New Order and all those characters. So that was the idea, to try to do these things as well as we could with as few people as we could, at least to start out.
And then just skipping over the bridge here, you've got another instrumental break that almost sounds like Pinball Wizard. Let me just play part of it. Even though the power guitar is there, it's actually much more restrained than when, you know, it's not the, yeah. It's not true right, Pinball right. Wizard tribute. It's just that,
well, you like it is a fast tribute. Rhythm.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for me, it's completely like we're playing rock music, right? And for me, I didn't grow up knowing Who music. My best friend was a huge Who fan and huge Pete Townsend fan. So much of it is absolutely a tribute to that. Also, it just felt like the right thing to do, mm-hmm. You know, it's, and I love those builds anyhow. So yeah, it was kind of like The Who and U2, they do those things beautifully. And that was kind of in the world.
Well, I labeled your initial guitar as fake delay because it sort of drop, like as if you were using a delay pedal. Well, clearly you're not, because then it just sustains that you're not turning it on, that you're just lots of downstroking.
Lots of downstrokes. Yep. That's actually one of the things that Lorenzo talked, we talked a lot about, which is sometimes I get in my head about the fact that I play guitar in a way that, you know, my guitar hero as a kid was Richie Havens. Hmm. So I tend to play all of the parts. And Lorenzo was really kind. And most of the time I have learned to try to stay out of the way of the drums and the bass. And Lorenzo was very generous and said, no, you should be doing the things that you naturally do. And that was really kind of fun for me, because I really do play all of these downstrokes and whatever. I mean, it's not brilliant playing or anything like that, but it's just very much how I play.
Yeah, I saw that you sort of had a start in your bio playing with a fairly direct connection to sort of the old folk scene.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as a rock and roll kid, you know, or just, so, right. My approach as a young person playing acoustic guitar was to kind of beat the shit out of it, sort of Violent Femmes,
Make it totally
a rhythmic instrument.
Yep.
So it is getting in the drummer's way, or at least you got to really lock in with the drummer, that becomes sort of the foundation of the band as you and the drummer.
It was definitely a thing for me to adjust to when I started to play with other people. And I know that, you know, my first drummer, like I had said, it was Ani Cordero. And I'm sure, you know, she was 16 and I was 19. And we had our first little foray into making a band together, sure, she was frustrated because it was like, not only was I sometimes playing five measures when I should have been playing four, because I had played solo for so long, I was just in my head, if I need another measure to figure out what I'm going to sing next, then I'll just do that.
The drummer just has to watch you. They just have to just follow me and my every little win.
Exactly.
And if I want to repeat the chorus an extra time, then you just have to pay attention.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. So that's how it went down.
Saying that this is essentially a show tune for a show that didn't get made makes this song make more sense to me. You know, obviously, you know, it's a nice single, but it also does, you know, what you were saying about that instrumental break and these dramatic moments. What was the apparent destination of this show? Why did it happen at some later time now that we're past COVID?
It was a show that started out as a little bit of this story that I had lived and wanted to tell, but it's kind of autofiction, you know, like it was about a group of friends who always seemed to know and be aware of things well before I ever was. So a very close friend of mine was very, very involved with the rave scene and was a very much a part of a community that she had all of these connections to. And for me, every part of that was culture shock and receiving it with some trepidation, but at the same time wishing that I, you know, was brave enough to do all of these things that these kids were doing. I was an observer. I've always been an observer. That's who I am. I wish I was quick and able to be responsive in a way. I'm always the person that looks back and goes, oh, I should have done that. I should have done this. Like I was saying about Berlin, I should have just stayed. But I was always thinking about the consequences. So the show is about us as friends rescuing our friend from, I guess, a youth facility in the middle of New England. They were kidnapped, essentially. We didn't know what happened to them. We had to figure out where they were and how to get them out. And so it's kind of all about that. That was the show. It was about friends trying to jailbreak a very, very close friend from a pretty horrible youth sobriety facility.
I get the theme, but what was the actual destination? Like, was there a theater in particular?
We were only in Table Reads and we were only in pre-production at that time. And originally, some of the music that we were going to make was for cast. You know, that was kind of was the beginning of it all. The destination would have just been anybody who would have had us, but we had a little bit of money to at least get a director and Lorenzo and myself enough to look at what it might look like. So that's kind of where it ended. We just started that process when COVID took over.
Well, let's get the second song out there. I had picked History of I Do from the album right before Gap Year, Figure Drawing, 2023. Can you say a little about where you're at? I guess this is still listed as officially an Among the Oak and Ash album. We haven't mentioned this. You know, you mentioned starting with maybe regrettably a band with your name, but then 2008 after, you know, sort of after your major label adventures, you started this, you know, very different project, which we'll hear something at the very end from the initial impetus of that. Sure. But I guess, so this is the third iteration of that band, but it's now back marketed as Josh Joplin Group after that first album.
Right. So basically we'd put out records on Verve for Among the Oak and Ash. And it was, you know, more or less supposed to be a project where I was teaming up for the first record. It was Garrison Starr, who is just a beloved person in my life. And we did that record and it just didn't sell, you know, and that's just what happens. We did another record called Devilship and it didn't sell. And I knew that this project, quote unquote, Among the Oak and Ash was going to be probably just three albums worth. The first one was sort of an introduction to us. The second one, I rewrote all of these folk narratives from other people's perspectives. And then the third one was going to be completely original music, all original music, and no references to folk music, I guess, at all, meaning you know, traditional folk music. So yeah, I had made the record. It was sitting there. Garrison had moved on to do other things, and this was going to be, for whatever reason, the final record, but it just sort of sat there. And by the time we were ready to put out Gap Year and all of those things, a very smart man who happens to manage me said, "Why are you doing all of this? This is ridiculous. Just put it out as Josh Joplin Group. We'll just make it available at least and do that. And then we'll put out Gap Year." And that was smart. And now everything is consolidated. And I'm actually really, truly attempting to get the first Among the Oak and Ash record from Verve to also be a Josh Joplin Group featuring Garrison Starr record, because you don't find it otherwise unless you know either one of us. So that's kind of the attempt I'm at now, after having spent nearly a decade trying to get the publishing stuff squared away.
Well, unless people have heard this podcast and they will know to separately look up Among the Oak Ampersand Ash. Okay. Exactly. All right. So History of I Do. Do you want to say a few words about that song in particular before we hear it?
I wrote it with a friend, and I don't typically co-write, but I wrote that with a friend, Wes Langlois, and I wrote the lyrics and he wrote the music, and it was just so much fun to do that. He's just such a tremendous songwriter that it was kind of an honor to be able to do it with him.
All right. I will link folks to a version I just noted on the internet with just the two of you.
Oh, cool.
Singing that together as an opening thing in a concert that you were doing. And I didn't realize that he'd written that, but it certainly sounded like the same harmony that we're hearing on this recording. Let's hear it.
Loaded down with adjectives for love. Burdened by remembrance of a fate we didn't choose. And so we splintered like a box, and so we remained. Holding on to every object it contained. And I think about you now like I've never done before. I miss you less.
right. So I won't ask you too much about the music if you didn't write the music, that, right? You said Wes wrote?
Yeah, Wes writes the music. I wrote the lyric. Yeah.
I guess still the overall sound of the band, right? This is much more Neil Young than...
Oh, that's kind.
You know, I forgot to mention with the first one, I know you've mentioned even in a song, like, oh, people say I sound like Michael Stipe.
Yeah.
But the first thing that struck me was Psychedelic Furs, which I,
that's a band so I
really
great.
Love from the, you know, the tone of your, you know, there's a certain forever now in Goodbye Berlin.
That's so nice of you, because to be honest, I didn't listen to REM and I did listen to Psychedelic Furs. So I always thought I was going to be more Richard Butler for me than anything. But honestly, it doesn't happen very much anymore. Maybe it's because REM is, you know, not
sure.
as prevalent. But most people who hear like Camera One for the first time, I think they think it's Michael Stipe potentially. But I have now, and I think this has a lot to do with what's going on Sirius XM and all that stuff with First Wave. I've heard more about sounding a little bit more Psychedelic Furs than I have ever heard in my whole life. There was one person who said I sounded like Cat Stevens, and I thought that's insane.
In that you're a baritone? I mean, that's not...
Yeah, I have no idea. I was like, what are you talking about?
I mean, I guess like it's insane. A compliment, you know, about a
Yeah, no. It's totally a compliment, I guess. But that was... And then sometimes I feel like I get... And this is completely possible that... I mean, I have huge... Elvis Costello was a huge influence on me, but I think sometimes I get compared to him because I wear glasses.
Okay. I mean,
yeah,
it's a Neo Dylan. Just like Elvis Costello is a Neo Dylan. It's a category of singer songwriter.
Yeah.
People want to make sense of
right.
things.
I guess. Yes. There you go.
So when you say he wrote the music, did he write the melody or did you do the melody and lyrics?
He wrote the melody and the chord. Yeah. The music and all of that. So I just gave him lyrics and we just tried this out. It was a blast.
What, just if you had noticed, and I didn't really notice it till you reprise at the end, the first line, but that's the opening line of Mercy Street of Peter Gabriel. So
I'm a huge fan. Yes. So maybe that says the, but it certainly wouldn't have been Wes's
head.
Yeah. That didn't come out of my, although I can appreciate that's definitely not Wes's bad. I think, but Wes said one time, he said, people ask me Beatles or Rolling Stones. I just tell them Buck Owens.
Well, all right. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. Pretty country through and through. I think his favorite band is Bread.
These are quite good lyrics.
Thank you.
Right. Loaded down with adjectives for a love we couldn't use, burdened by remembrance of a fate we didn't choose. And so we splintered like a box, and so we remained holding on to every object it contained. Do you have a big notebook of lyrics that you just were ready to pull this out, or?
I do write lyrics down and things like that that I think might be lyrics, but that just kind of was one of those things. I couldn't find the right melody for it. And I had written a melody to it, but I was like, you know who I should try this out with is Wes, because we'd always threatened to work with each other that way as songwriters. And he turned it around. And there is a version of that that rocks super heavy, very, very Neil Young. Neil Young is a big influence on Wes, especially. When we first played it, it was heavy, heavy. And then for the record, I kind of made a different choice about it. I wanted it to be a lot more about sorrow.
Yes, it's kind of a mournful song. If you really, mm-hmm. you know, not that you can't really rock a mournful song. There's a certain power to that. Yeah, this chorus, and I love triple negatives. Mm-hmm. Kind of, I think about you now like I've never done before, and I guess I miss you less a whole lot more. I'm trying to even just untwist that. Of
yes,
exactly. is this a nostalgic song or is this a you're still in a relationship song? It was not totally clear to me.
I think it's kind of that point where you're sometimes in a relationship with somebody and you're not sure that you're ready to let go, but you know you need to, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
So increasingly, I do not miss you when we are not together. There I have I've removed the semantic ambiguity.
Yeah, and you know, that is how it is, isn't it? You know, you kind of like, if you're in love with somebody and they go away for whatever reason, you know, and it's just the cliche, you know, it's time, you need time. And that's a little bit of it. But sometimes you're thinking about that time, even when you're in the relationship and they're, you know, it's dissipating.
Well, and then you bring in a metaphor. I thought I heard a deer in the woods in despair. There's despair. You say it right there. Like a scout with heightened senses, it was searching the air, and I only saw it when it ran and left me to live. Never had so much as when I had nothing to give. Yes, we could pile metaphor on top of metaphor, but we just have a little diversion here before we're back to repeating the chorus. Any thought about the structure here, if you even think about such things?
For me, at least, I think sometimes there's surprises, and there's nothing more surprising than a woodland animal coming out from the bush, and you might be walking in the woods and suddenly you see their eyes, or you get this glimpse. And I think there's some correlation between that spark of acknowledgement of love and hate and disappointment and surprise. Those are all things that kind of come to me, at least, in those relationships that don't work out.
That could be the foundation of a song. But no, it's just one of the verses that we've got here. And the road rendered me incomplete. Blue lines everywhere. Two places meet. Take over where maps just disappear. The only home I'd known I couldn't find here. We're continuing sort of in the nature or geography, at least, metaphors. But we've moved on from the deer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any thought about exactly how many times... Right, because we started loaded down with adjectives for a love we couldn't use, which is a really cool concept, not a metaphor, had nothing to do with the outdoor and deers and things like that.
Sometimes I kick myself because it's been such a huge influence in my life, and I talk about this in bio after bio, I'm sure. I left school when I was 16 in the 10th grade, and I lived in a van like Jewel for a good couple of years, just kind of roaming. And the biggest influence in my life was William Lee Sheetmoon's Lost Highways. And I have to say, and I need to stop doing it, but I go back to some of the loneliest moments of my life were me in my little camper van. But there was such a freedom to my experience. So it would always outweigh the desperation. So for me, I think the road can be really, really hard. And I am really lucky. My life was 2 or 3 years of ridiculous touring. And I had been kind of prepared for it because I spent 2 years sort of doing it already, not as a touring musician, but just as a traveling kid trying to figure out my life, you know. But I do have many friends that are on the road 200 days a year. You know, it's hard to even be friends with a musician because they're gone so often. And I really feel for them. I feel for their families. I know what a toll that can take. But same toll that maybe being a trucker or you know, a pilot or...
Well, lots of opportunities to miss people, yes, out there. Just one more question about the music before we get the third one out there. So the nice, mournful steel guitar, was that Wes's thing? Was that just part of the band you were working with at the time? How was you said?
No, actually, that's Fats Kaplan. He's a very, very well-known steel player. And Fats is really, well, first of all, he's just a wonderful, wonderful person. But he's so talented. And then... he can play everything. He's a wonderful mandolin player, violin, fiddle, pedal steel. He's known for being able also to create these kind of soundscapes, which he does all over figure drawing. But you think, oh, this person has, their talent has no bounds. And then he can do close-up magic. It's like no one's business. And he can play, he has a Hawaiian ukulele band that plays authentic ukulele music and also music from the 1920s. And just so many things and so many values, I guess, that I align with his curiosity and his love of music. He played with Roy Bookbinder as a kid and then plays with Jack White, and he's Mitski, I think, is who he's playing with now. And he's a very, very wonderful contributor to the Nashville, but also the American music scene, and anybody who wants to hear him even more, those are good places to start.
Well, I'm going to take this as a segue to our third tune, going all the way back to 1997 to Boxing Nostalgic. The song I picked was Juniper, because this is another sort of somewhat mournful, but you know, at least it's a travel song. Actually, I wrote a tune in like 91 that was initially called just Running at Night, because I wrote it while jogging at night.
Uh-huh.
And this has that feeling, you know, we're at night. It's an urban thing in a car or walking around. It's unclear. But anyway, yeah. Can you say a little about where you're at back then and this song before we hear it?
So there's a street in Atlanta called Juniper. That would probably be the place to begin. And there was a club in Atlanta called Backstreets. And so it's kind of just a dedication to a really beautiful space for people to be themselves. And at night, getting to see, as they say, the freaks come out. I got to see all that because I lived there, and I lived on Juniper, or at least nearby in Midtown. It's a little bit about kind of like how a city, when it shuts down, there's a whole other city. We all know that, you know, so that's a little bit of what it is.
All right. To warn people, a little bit of a longer tune, but it's still under 6 minutes compared to some of the prog rockers that I have on here with their 15-minute songs. It'll yes. breeze by. But yeah, I really like the feel of this one. Let's hear it.
Church bells, the voice. sleeping. And the boys in drag walking to the club like lonely souls, each anxious for new love. And I am leaving while Juniper sleeping.
All right, so we have a lot of verses here with kind of a little tag at the end. I'd call it a mini chorus. And yeah, how did you think of this? This is mostly just like we're going to run with the same rhythm more or less.
Yep.
But you're going to vary up the guitar subtly here and there, and you're going to have piano come in and out. And yeah, it seems like this could go on. Was there a little Velvet Underground sort of influence here?
Yeah, I'd definitely say it was supposed to be meditative, right? Because nighttime for me, I guess I always love that feeling of you're floating inside and outside of something. Yeah. So it's supposed to have this kind of meditative thing. And it was a poem originally, which is pretty corny for a musician to say, but that is how it started. And then I put it to music. I didn't create lots of different parts to it. It really is just a tagline.
For something meditative, the drums are quite spastic and loud, you know, for, you know, it's not just the little quiet, the river flows into the sea,
right?
Meditative. So this is Jason Bucher. Is that?
Yeah, Jason Bucher.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So Jason's a brilliant drummer, and I think he really always learned how to, he always understood how to play around my playing. And that was really, I really always have appreciated that. He could kind of do anything. So when we were talking about it, I wish I could remember if I gave a reference to it. But for the most part, my guitar is, you know, just these sort of electric soundscapey things. And then I'm just hitting an A note and over and over and over and over and over again with sort of this, it's not a hammer on, but it's almost like the opposite of a hammer off, I guess, if that's a term. And it's just over and over and over and over. And Alan putting in his kind of Alan Wakeman moment, speaking of prog rock, you know, kind of like, yeah, there's just like a lot of different ideas to try to create nighttime without it becoming sleepy.
Yeah, let me play. I wrote piano descending adds chordal complexity, right? Because you want to just drone on this thing, but if you just throw in a few jazz notes.
Boys in drag, walking to the club.
Yeah, just any thought about how you're navigating the different energy levels here? And
Alan, he's playing the piano and still plays with me, and is part of the group, as we talked about. I think he very much influenced by jazz, and I love jazz as well. I like bebop and early jazz. I also like big band, and Jason liked, you know, Miles Davis and Bitches Brew and the kind of fusion jazz.
Well, it's the mood of that. Yeah, because there was actually a point in around 2000 where I was trying to start a new band, and like I really was inspired by that mellowness, that sound of kind of blue. Yeah, there's just something so delicate about that, which I hear a little bit of
brilliant
feeling around that here.
And Alan is a student much more so than I am of jazz. I remember Alan introducing me to Oscar Brown Jr. and he was spot on because that's exactly the kind of stuff I loved. I was a big Mose Allison fan and huge Bud Powell fan. I'm still a big Bud Powell fan and Mose Allison fan, but he spanned everything. So I think when we're hitting those things, it's like trying to eke out all of these elements from a song that's essentially one chord. It is a raga, if you will. You know, it's like there's just, it does not really change. How do we do all of this? I really am grateful. Thank you for hearing all of those things.
We haven't really talked about your philosophy of harmony vocals, right? You have so many verses here, and yet you're going to keep the harmonies for Only Is, Only Dreaming, you know, the tag that's at the end of every verse here, which I would not be able to resist, you know, by verse four, verse five, verse six, start layering a little bit, put an extra vocal on there. But it was this sort of a dedication to the maximizing its raga potential, but that we're not going to orchestrate it in a linear way. It's not going to grow as it goes necessarily. It's just going to have these are the characters that come in and out. What's your thought about not harmonizing more in general?
The song is rather narrative, and there's a kind of a character. There's a whole being there kind of thing. By that, I just mean like Chauncey Gardner, you know, like you're just there. And so probably the idea was, let's make this singular. This is as a sort of a witness to it, because if you brought other people into it, you know, potentially then it sounds like there's a crowd. That song isn't really about a crowd. It's about being a part of other people's visibility at night when they come out. All of these different people that are going to the club or that are working, and people who are walking home, taxi cab drivers who are picking those people up. It's all about sort of witnessing life in a city on a quiet but active place if you know where to look.
Well, I suppose in general, the more full of imagery the lyrics have, the more you're generally coming from a Bob Dylan folky kind of place, which does not lend itself to heaps of harmonies, right? The Dylan to Birds transition is, we no longer know what we're singing about because we didn't write these things, but we'll have nice harmonies over them.
Totally.
Which, you know, Neil Young navigates around that nicely between delivering things in his solo, you know, especially in that little high voice that, you were kind of using that more on History of I Do, that you were in a different vocal range that, you know, nobody's going to say, you sound like Michael Stipe on that one.
Well, I couldn't sing as high as I can sing now. So it's I'm having a very interesting evolution. My range is far better now than it was when I was younger. And I probably just didn't test it out nearly as much when I was younger. But the singing thing has really been kind of fascinating. I also took a lot of time off of touring, not necessarily writing or playing music. And I did write the show and things like that too, but to be a stay-at-home dad. And I think maybe that helped. I don't know.
Well, I also noticed on Goodbye Berlin, it didn't sound like there was any auto-tune on it.
No.
Okay. I mean, that seems, well, what you were describing with you singing in the room with your bass player in front, like, I wasn't sure if things were isolated enough that would even make sense, especially you know, if you're playing while, yes, the recent thing I'm recorded recently was do the whole album playing acoustic while singing in, like, so you can't fix the tuning. It's got to be good enough.
Well, so my general rule in it, and maybe this brings us full circle, you know, useful music started out with a producer, Rob Gow, who's a very close friend and still plays with me, and we're quite tight. 25 years ago, we started that record out with Rob Gow. Then Sean Mullins, who is also a very good friend of mine, said, hey, I want to produce a record. And we saw that as a really generous opportunity for us as a band to have Sean and his expertise kind of bringing out. Rob started with rock and demos and all of these things, and also brought on a lot of the elements of samples and drum loops and things like that. Then Sean kept a lot of those samples and brought in Anthony AJ Resta, who was amazing. And he came in and did a bunch more of those things. And then Artemis Records sent us to Peter Collins to do a version of I've Changed, and then Jerry Harrison took over. I guess what I'm trying to say is when I said I had one foot in the old industry and one foot in the new industry, the old industry would be, hey, let's send you to a bunch of producers and try to get these songs as big and as radio ready as they could possibly be. And there's no limit to my gratitude for having had that experience. But I will say this, I would never, ever in a million years do that again. And so from the time we recorded The Future That Was through every single thing I've ever recorded since 2001, I do everything I can to make things live because I just never want to relive, although that sounds very trauma-oriented. I just would never want to record a record like we recorded Useful Music. And I'm proud of Useful Music, but it also speaks to the times. And that's the part that fascinates me most about it, is all of the things that Useful Music represents is a chapter in time, the chapter of, you know, the late 90s and the early 2000s, but it's also the money that was spent was extraordinary. I bet Peter Collins alone was $40,000, you know, just to record in Nashville at Ocean Way. All of those things fascinate me, and I'm really, really intrigued. And I've always wanted to write a book with a friend of mine who was the promoter of Camera One from both sides of the world. I don't think he's as interested in doing it as I am. But what was it like to be a musician in 2000, 2001? It was a kind of a really, really weird, strange time to be making music. Like, you know, as a band, we were doing these radio shows and we did them with Fuel and Smash Mouth and we did them with Pink and boy bands. So it's just an odd, strange concoction of wild music going on because there was no alternative to the gatekeepers. That was just about to happen. Napster would introduce that. And of course, the music industry would react to that.
I've been looking through the Useful Music wiki page and, you know, which producer was on which track. I've Changed from that has actually been the song that has been just not leaving my head since I started prepping for this. It seems like with the momentum, it could have been a two-hit wonder, you know, at least. what was the second single off this?
So I was on a record label called Artemis Records, and it was headed up by two of the titans of the industry. And that's another insight that I love that I have. You know, it was Danny Goldberg, who was a very famous manager, and he started out as a very famous publicist, and Daniel Glass, who he's been on radio. He's responsible for so many hit records and has another chapter in his life now where he's responsible for Phoenix and Mumford and Sons and all of these other things. I had such a unique and wonderful experience because Daniel, who signed me, they were two sides of the coin for me. Daniel was just so responsive to what he imagined Josh Joplin Group could be. And Danny was very responsive to Josh Joplin, the guy who liked Phil Oakes. And he was much more responsive to just my background. His father and I were pals, you know, Victor, and his father hung out in the office. So I'm saying all that because they both agreed, I think, and this is me, I'm just projecting this, but I think it's true. They both agreed that they loved I've Changed. And they thought that would be the second single. But again, 2001 or 2000 or whenever we were recording, how are we going to make this the single? We can't use that version that we know. Let's send Josh and the gang to Nashville to make a new version with Peter Collins. And then that version was going to be the single. And I will say that I was the fly in the ointment for that. And I don't know if it could have been a single. I want to state steadfastly, I really love working with Peter Collins and really thought the whole thing was very, very special in many ways. But when it was all said and done, I just couldn't bear that version of the song. And so I think I probably took the wind out of Danny and Daniel's sails when it came to making that the second single. To their credit, they put it as the additional track on the record when they had every right to just put it on the record. We had no rights as a band to do anything. Again, 2001, that's how it was.
All right. Well, I will link folks to that alternate version, the version that went on the album. Plus, you have a version on Projectorhead on the 1996 album. So, you know, this is a song that had some legs and made it, you know, from your pre-label days to the big break.
I credit Daniel for that, too. He really looked at all of the songs that I had, you know, we had recorded, and he just loved that song. He brought it, I believe, to Danny, and that's where it all kind of started. It'll also be on the Useful Music Silver Anniversary streaming July 10th.
The Future That Was came out pretty quickly after Useful Music. Then Jaywalker. I think both Future That Was and Jaywalker are just really excellent albums.
Thank you.
Was it Jaywalker was when the label support ended, when the sort of that trip of that iteration of band ended?
No, it's just a different label.
Okay.
We made The Future That Was with Rob Gal, who I mentioned earlier. We were going to make that record with Adam Schlesinger, who I was doing a bunch of pre-production with, and he couldn't do it, and he was working on Crank Yankers at the time. He was doing the music, I think, for that.
Okay.
So that took over, and my record kind of got pushed aside, although we did record in his studio, which was also James E. Hall's studio, and Rob Gal, who I mentioned earlier, was the producer on that one. For Artemis Records, I don't know when Artemis really shuttered, but I know that after that record, there was very little going on at Artemis. I think it continued a little bit longer. I think they had a few other folks, but you know, this is a record label that had all kinds of artists, from Steve Earle and Warren Zevon to Kitty and Pretenders and Jay Maskus. So it was a very interesting label, but I would imagine its biggest hit was Baha Men's Who Let the Dogs Out. You know, Camera One, I think, may have been the second. Maybe there's another hit. Maybe Steve Earle had some sort of hit. I don't know. But at that time, to sell bunches of records, and I remember my records a disappointment because it only sold like 500,000. That's a disappointment in that time.
Okay.
Boy bands were selling, you know, 500,000 records an hour.
Well, all this was just I was trying to get at the build up that there was some sort of label activity, and then you have this, maybe a pause, maybe this is when you had your kids, but then we had eventually this album under the other name, the Oak and the Ash.
Right. So yeah, we did Artemis and then Yep Rock and then Verve. So I was always on labels. So I'm very, you know, lucky, I guess. You know, I don't mean to say I guess as if it's a throwaway, but just meaning like I was always on labels. So I didn't have a very long experience doing the DIY thing. I came out of Among the Oak and Ash having made two records. And then the third record, which we talked about, which was Figure Drawing, I was really trying to shop a label that I thought might pick up where we left off, but that was not to happen. And that really became the impetus for me to took time off to be a stay-at-home dad to my daughter. And then I came back to music, wanting to do the last Among the Oak and Ash record. That not necessarily getting off the ground. Writing the show was always happening. I was always busy, I guess. And then Gap Year happened. And that's kind of really, truly the reintroduction of, I'm going to go touring again. My daughter has graduated college and she's on her, you know, her life's journey, and I can do all of these things, and I'm in a very happy and good place. So this is what I do. And so, but in between all of that, you know, I made little indie movies. You know, I did do things other than just be a, you know, strictly a parent, but that was my job. You know, just to be a stay-at-home dad, my wife traveled and worked quite a bit. So I wanted to have that experience, but I also wanted our daughter to have the experience where her parents were in her life.
Well, let's wrap up here by just introducing, we're going to leave folks with one of the original tunes from that first Among the Oak and Ash albums. It's 2008, And it's the self-titled album. High, Low, and Wide was one of the two originals on theirs. There's a lot of nice traditional tunes. Cool version of All the Pretty Little Horses. I wasn't expecting that out of you. Shady Grove, other stuff. The Housewife's Lament, I especially like. But this one, yeah, High, Low, and Wide. Can you, I guess, yes, to say goodbye, tell us a little about this project, this choice.
My father had died, and I don't know, I was trying to put that through my process, I guess, of grief, and that song, that's where it came from. And I had a bridge that I was doing, and Garrison was like, you know, maybe we should do this. And boy, was she right. It was really nice because we didn't write together, Garrison and I. You know, maybe we did a little bit, but not really. She came up with a way to complete the song and did it brilliantly. And she's a wonderful person, but also a really fabulous musician and songwriter and guitarist and producer. I really appreciated that because it didn't work the way I was doing it, and she made it work. We did it with our friends, you know, like Among the Oaken Ash is a bunch of people who play with other people. Brian Owings plays with Emmy Lou Harris, and he's always played with us. And, you know, Fats is another example of Among the Oaken Ash kinds of characters. All these people from the other side of Nashville that I'm drawn to, and my very, very good friend, Brian Harrison, who has since passed away, brought us all sort of into this place where we were comfortable enough to let our emotions run amok on that record. And I really appreciate that too.
All right. Thanks for chatting. Here's High, Low, and Wide.
I am but a shadow cast upon the road, and we are all but strangers bearing a heavy load. And all these worldly things you won't need anymore. You'll only take your place standing on that shore.
Yeah. get back home. You've got to cross and roam. You've got to cross and
thanks so much to Josh. It's always great to see Beneath a one-hit wonder, whose one hit, though very catchy, is easily confused with other songs from that time. So it's always great to see that the person behind that is a real, very strong songwriter with a body of work. You can learn more about his music at joshjoplingroup.com. If you happen to have just stumbled across this recording and are not subscribed to Nakedly Examined Music, you may want to do that. NakedlyExaminedMusic.com has all of your links and also a little widget to leave a nice 5-star, say, review of the show if you feel so inclined. The other place you may want to check out is patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, which will make your experience of this show ad-free henceforth. And so from those Patreons, I link you to the Google Doc that has the detailed notes on the songs that I use to prep. But even the blog posts, whether at Patreon or NakedlyExaminedMusic.com or PartiallyExaminedLife.com, I always collect some links to YouTube resources so you could see the artist playing live. In this case, Camera One being Josh's big hit, we've got the original video from back in the day, 2001. We've got the Silver Anniversary new recording video. There's also a video for a so-called solo version, but also a live version. Actually solo, just him and a guitar in a cafe, and from back in the day playing it live on Letterman. So even just getting a snapshot chronology of the various things he's done with that tune, I think is fascinating. And you can see him live with Garrison Starr as Okinash, with Wes as a duo, playing History of I Do, that song we discussed that they wrote together, and lots of other stuff. The episodes I've recorded since talking to Josh include one with Dan Montgomery, a great rootsy singer-songwriter, and then most recently, Glenn Morrow, who is best known as a label guy, who is longtime an executive at Bar None Records, helped the careers of a lot of wonderful bands. But of course, he was a band leader back in the late 70s, early 80s, and has reemerged with a new band, Glenn Morrow's Cry for Help, that has released 3 albums now. Very good stuff. Hope you come back to join me for that. Finally, if you did not get the word, I am teaching another online philosophy class this fall. This one on philosophy of mind. You can look at partiallyexaminedlife.com/class for details of that. Or if you're listening to this way later, whatever class might be coming up. Hope your summer is continuing to go well. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.